Hello and welcome to Pond Jumpers, the international podcast for open source developers. This is episode 10, discussion about JavaScript and its explosion of libraries and frameworks, recorded October 13th, 2011. Hi, I'm Josh Long and I work for SpringSource.
Hello, my name is Greg Turnquist and I also work for SpringSource. And I wanted to welcome Josh to this episode of Pond Jumpers. Thanks for joining me here. And, our main subject here, as Josh just said, was we're going to talk about JavaScript, and there's just a whole swirl of stuff around that. But before we dive into that, I did want to take a little moment here and have a little tribute. There's two big sort of tech giants that have passed away recently: Steve Jobs, which is probably better known to the general consumer world, and Dennis Ritchie, who is probably well known in the computer developer world, the founder of the C programming language. So, my last job, I worked on I had a Dell workstation with Windows computers and stuff. And when I went to join SpringSource back in 2010, they said you can have a Windows desktop machine or you can have a Mac setup. And I leapt at the chance to work with the Mac platform. And at the time, I had to give up my company phone and go buy my own, so I went and bought an iPhone. So for the past year and a half, I've been using the Apple stack, and I've enjoyed that product suite better than what my old hardware was, but you know, there's other things that I don't like about the iPhone, like flash support and things like that. So, you know, it's been fun, and I've always known that my back door is I could always just wipe the machine and reload it with Ubuntu Linux if I got fed up with it.
Yeah, I found that approach to be very natural. I got the MacBook Pro just like you did from the for the company device, but I'm using a Refit REFIT to run Linux on my Mac, and people look at me with a puzzled face. Why would you do something so detrimental to the machine? And you know, I just want my Linux. It just works.
Well, I was at the point on my old desktop computer I used to have. I had converted all my home computers to Ubuntu Linux a couple years ago. When I got married, I was able to train my wife, who was a computer illiterate person, to be able to do her Facebooking and stuff like that on a Linux desktop. So when people say, is this the year of the Linux desktop? I'm like, I've been living the year of the Linux desktop for several years, and I have proof of that.
it's here to stay. By the way, did you see the, 11.10 Ubuntu?
Yes, I saw that on Twitter, and I have no idea how to pronounce the name of that.
Nor I just thought it was very interesting. Right on the heels of the Lion update. For OS X. Are you using that, by the way?
No, and from everything I've seen, heck no. I don't know. I've heard grief coming out of that, so I don't think I'm going to upgrade until they force me, and then I may be considering the Ubuntu Linux route. But I had a coworker that he at his house he had a Dell Windows Vista computer maybe or 2000. He had a MacBook Pro and he had an Ubuntu computer. So wow. He was diverse, you could say, but
yeah.
he told me that, this is what I didn't know at the time, he explained to me that Mac OS X is based on OpenBSD, so I said, does that mean there's like a shell? And see, if I couldn't have the shell, then I would have, you know, I never would have gone for OS X, because I'm a command line junkie.
Naturally. Command line navigator. Are you a Bash or a K-shell guy?
I'm Bash. Well, what's evil and bad is the university I went to, they had Sun Workstation, so I got trained on C#. So I've had people berate me for that, and I'm used to Solaris and stuff, and being at college and also at my old job, and I would go to, used to go to the Melbourne Linux Users Group in Florida when I lived down there, and I would say Solaris, and they would go, oh, you mean Slolaris.
Ow! Oh, don't pick on Solaris. I've had some. I wouldn't use it now, but I've got some good memories, man. Back in the 90s, you find me any other operating system that you could yank the RAM out of the machine from, and still have it, you know, carry on as though it didn't miss a beat. That thing was a.
I had no problems with it. You know, I had a, you know, I've had like three people come or no. Total of seven people that worked for me at my old job, that they joined my team, and I forced them to learn VI because I told them, okay, you're going to be accessing servers through a terminal server, there is no text editor available but VI, so this is your only choice. And only one of them said, can I use Emacs? And I said, if you can install it, you can use it. He never did. He eventually learned VI, so I was like, this is what you're stuck with. You can get on the console occasionally, but you're going to run into situations where you got to go through some,
yeah,
some port, and then that's all you got left. So you better learn it now.
Yeah, but it's not that bad. You tell a computer stalwart developer about Unix, and you say, well, this is what you should use to build systems, and they look at you with that, you know, dull in the headlights look. They don't realize it's actually quite easy and quite nice, and it's consistent, you know? It doesn't keep you up at night. We owe a lot to dentistry, I think.
Yeah, and that's the big thing, is Unix is bit, you know, sits on top of C. C is the language, and I think C still holds the record of total most lines of code ever written is in C.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm correct. And so I wrote a blog article earlier today about where, you know, I've used to be in the computer club in high school, so I'm the picture of white and nerdy. There was a guy that came from Auburn University and gave a demonstration on facial recognition software that they'd built, like neural network software. And I asked him what they wrote this code in, and he said C, and I was like, C, what is
absolutely
that? And I went and looked it up, and I was, you know, I started gobbling that up, and I played with stuff like Logo and Basic and Pascal up until then. So to me, C was my first grown-up language. So by the time I got to college, you know, and I, you had to study C and then Unix right after that, I had a jump start. While everyone else was learning C, I was learning the Unix.
Right.
And
portable assembler, man.
Never look back on that.
Nor I. Well, so Dennis, wasn't he also heavily one of the founders of Unix itself? Not just the language, but like things like Multics and so on?
I think so. I think I looked at that briefly I looked at his entry, it was in a news article, whatever, and they mentioned something like that.
Right. We just spent the last few minutes talking about our experiences, you know, from decades past with Unix and C, and it all started with that one guy. I mean, just imagine if there had been no Unix, you know, what the world would have been like today.
You know, and I think about what's going to happen now. You know, there's some other big giants out there that what happens on the day they pass away. And I think, you know, the next person I think of is like Linus Torvalds.
Don't say that. Oh, don't say that.
You know, 30 years from now or something, and it's going to be like, where can you imagine Linux being 30 years from now? You know, that was bringing Unix to the 386 platform.
Well, so you just touched upon something very interesting. You realize Linux just celebrated its 20th birthday.
Yes,
20
that's right.
Years of Linux. And I mean, the mind boggles. I couldn't even believe it's been around for 20 years. I remember the original, do you remember when Byte Magazine and Wired and all that stuff, these guys had all these posts about this crazy guy in, what was it, Finland or something? Where's Linus from?
Yeah, Finland, that's right.
Yeah, all these great posts about this crazy student in Finland who's taking the world by storm and talking trash about Microsoft, and, you know, just it's hard to believe that was 20 years ago.
I have the first issue in my closet. I can pull it out. I have the first issue of Enter Magazine, which was it was a computer magazine for kids. It came from the same publishing house as Children's Television Workshop. So, I mean, this is a magazine that had little articles about computer games and stuff, and in the back they had little basic programming exercises in it. And I think my folks did. When they found out I was into computers, I think they realized this was something bigger than I realized it was. So they bought things like that to help provide.
Encourage. We need that. I think today's kids, if they're to be called literate, they need to know how to use computers. You know, I feel like there's less of it available for them than there should be. Not more. You know, the common denominator for all jobs today is computer skills. You know, basically.
Yeah, now there's this now, because it used to be computers wasn't, you know, cool. So the only people that were in computer circles were those that, you know, started at a much younger age than college. And so those are the passionate developers that can really, you know, really know the stuff. But then once it became cool and money making, then more people got drawn to it at the college level. And I think that's where some of the, you know, the substandard and the average make my buck kind of developer comes from, that now you're competing with and trying to tell your manager No, we need to hire the good guy, not the average guy. We don't want
to the 9-to-5 guy.
We don't want to source it out to Elbonia.
Well, so we have. I mean, that's interesting too. Is we've gotten to a point where through the power of a lot of abstraction and better tooling, we're able to. I'm not saying that these people should be writing the next pacemaker or anything, but it is conceivable to get a programmer who's not particularly well-grounded in computer science lore and get some results out of that, out of that guy. And I think that's we're getting there. We're getting to literate computing. We're getting to that place where developers now are they're a little bit of everything. And in fact, a lot of people today are starting, believe it or not, with JavaScript. They get the itch to build these little widgets, these animations on the page, and the next thing you know, next thing you know, it's the guy that built Scriptaculous, or something like that. It's amazing. I mean, I think JavaScript is the new BASIC. People started with BASIC back in the day. Nowadays, it's starting in the browser.
Yeah, that's true. Now you'll find a blog article that tells you if you wrote BASIC ever, then you harmed yourself permanently or something. Someone wrote an article like that.
Well, I think,
I understand where that comes from because I there were things I had to unlearn from it, but I don't think I could quite make that statement.
It's a snide. Of course, people are snide about these kind of things. All programming experience amounts to something helpful eventually. I mean, more is more, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I just think it's at this point we're facing a new generation, a new era now. It's amazing to think that the first programming language for a lot of these people going to school now is, JavaScript. I mean, that's the language, and then eventually they translate that, hopefully. Maybe PHP or something is the next natural step. They decide to exercise their skills on the server side instead, or things like Node.js.
Can we detour around PHP if possible?
Oh, I'm working on it. Work with me here. And I don't think it's even that far a stretch to say that you could get from JavaScript to Java. I think it's the concepts are of course very different. But it's not different enough in syntax that somebody who knows JavaScript would be intimidated, from a couple blushes of Java, and that I feels like it would be enough for somebody to get into Java and eventually start slinging Java code,
Well, and based on what we're talking about, I want to take this opportunity and kind of segue into our main subject here on. The subject of JavaScript and how, today, if you go to github.com and search on for JavaScript tools and stuff or libraries, there's just this explosion of libraries out there to pick from, toolkits of different caliber stuff. And I remember, speaking with one of my coworkers over lunch and, his own remark that these tools have matured a lot compared to what people were doing with JavaScript 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I have to confess, I wouldn't say illiterate, but I'm definitely a JavaScript newbie. For the past 10 years, or I should say, subtract to the last 2 years from this, but my old job, for about 10 years, I was working on thick client interfaces in a proprietary language called Forte 4GL.
Anything to do with a security framework called Forte?
Security? No, there was a small company in Oakland, California called, I forget what they're called. They built this proprietary language and it was a write once, run anywhere thing. They had their own, the IDE and the code were all like together in one tool. And they had their own language. They had things like inline SQL support. So you could take a widget and assign it a value. You could assign it a SQL select statement, and it would be dragging the data content right into the widget.
Data bound.
Even though that violates, I don't know how many different sensible programming ideas to do that, but...
Sure. Well, that's common on .NET, right? You have these data bound controls, and do you remember JSF Page Creator, whatever it was called, four or five years ago?
Well, what I'm alluding to is the fact that because I worked on thick client stuff, I never really worked on in the web space. And even at the 2008 Spring One conference, when Ben Alex was giving a presentation. He says, how many people are writing web apps? And everybody raised their hand but me. And so that what it meant is it's like the HTML that I had learned was from about, 12 years ago. And I really hadn't learned JavaScript. So then in my, my new assignment with this company was I suddenly had to go fix a bug that was in the web layer, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing here. And so I had to go start reading up on Dojo, and somebody pointed me to the w3school.com site, and that helped start getting me going again. And I'm playing serious catch up, though. I know how to design screens and things like that. I just have to learn how to do it with the JavaScript world.
Oh yeah, and I think that's the common refrain for a lot of people. I think a lot of people are coming to JavaScript and looking at it as though it's basically the assembler of the web. It has that same ubiquity that C enjoyed in Unix, and it's thus considered very low level for a lot of people. A lot of people are coming to it and saying, well, I need a framework, or in some cases they're saying, I want to just eschew the language altogether. They're going to these new cross compilers like GWT for Java or CoffeeScript, right? But that's one of those popular ones that has a lot of support, right? I mean, have you seen? I'm sure you've seen information about that out there.
Yeah, I've started reading bits and pieces about that because it's suddenly, I see like it's suddenly gotten a lot of popularity through Twitter. So I was like, well, let me go check that out. And I'm really, more than anything, I'm glad I got into Twitter because I feel like that is keeping me in the loop on what's hot, what are people using technology-wise. So it tips me off what to go read. And I feel like before I had Twitter and before I used Google News Reader and was monitoring 100 different blogs, I didn't know what the heck was happening out there. I had was books, and you can't keep up on books.
No, but that you could, I wish you could. And in fact, I feel like that's another casualty of the information age. We have if you go to the local bookstores, this is of course partly due to the recession, but I just feel like in general, the creme of the crop, the best information out there is now online a lot of times,
Well, I think you and I both know a little bit about that because we originally met through authoring circles.
That's true.
I joined SpringSource back in early 2010, and I was wrapping up a book called Spring Python 1.1 with Pack Publishing.
Great book.
Thank you. And I think I forgot if it was Adam Fitzgerald that put out the word that they were looking for somebody to help do a review so they could get their little Spring stamp on it for your Spring Recipe second edition.
Yeah.
So I was like, me, let me have a crack at it. So they sent me some drafts and I looked at them and I was like, wow, this is some good material here. And,
And then it kept on coming, and now you regretted it, right? 1,000 pages later.
Well, when they finally shipped me the printed copy, I was like, "Oh man, this thing's a doorstop. It's a tome."
Yeah, don't drop it from a building. It'll hurt people.
But I sifted through, and I was like, "This is some chunky material here." And but I
don't know.
But it was a few months after I got that though that Pack Publishing actually contacted me and said, "Hey, we want to go write a cookbook." I was like, a cookbook? It's like, I've seen cookbooks, and they had apparently had a Python testing beginner's guide that was real popular, but a lot of the feedback was, we want more more code examples, so we want to write a Python testing cookbook. And I was about to say no, because this other book had eaten up so much of my time. And
like they do.
Yeah, and at the time I started writing is when we had our first baby.
Oh, my.
So, eat that. But... But we're at the drive-thru at Starbucks, and my wife looks at me and says, I think we should strike while the iron's hot. You should go for it. I was just, I was jolted by that. Like, I didn't expect that. So I said, sure, and, about a year later, I got that one done. Though it's no tome like that Spring Recipes second edition.
Well, we had help on that one. That was quite the effort. And we built upon the foundation laid by the lead author, Gary Mack, in the first edition.
Now you just finished or are finishing your another one right now on Rue.
Yeah, that one's finished. Actually, good point. That's if you go to springsource.org/Rue, it's a bit, the people at O'Reilly have graciously made the book available for free.
Wow.
So there's a link there on the top of the page, springsource.org/Rue.
Well, that's very generous.
You can still buy the printed version, of course, from the O'Reilly website. I should say that. But if you want to get the PDF and download it right now, just go to that website.
Okay, so attention all listeners, I think Josh is you know, he's poor. He doesn't have much food to eat. So go out and buy the copy, the printed copy.
No, I'm not, to all listeners. Whether I'm poor or not, you guys should go get that book. It's out there for free. It's good stuff.
All right. So I wanted to take a chance to swing that in there.
I appreciate it.
So I don't know. I was happy when I actually, because we'd already corresponded. I was happy to find out when you were like, "Hey, I'm going to join Spring Source too." And I was like, "Really? Well, that's awesome."
Yeah, that was a great, a great year, 2010. I got to work with you, and then, now we're on the same LDAP directory, email directory. Good company to be with. A lot of smart people, and it's amazing. We have, of course, all the normal things that we're talking about. We have all, Spring, the framework. We have these technologies. But again, it brings us all back around to sort of one of the big use cases is people want to build bigger and better applications on the client. A lot of times they're going to talk to some sort of back end, that might be REST, for example, in Spring MVC. But generally the demand right now is help me build better mobile applications, help me build better rich applications, And we've got, people are starting to build their entire application, their entire all the forms, all the dialogues, all the interactivity, all the business logic on the client using JavaScript. There's this phrase I first heard Matt Rabel say it. It was called a SOFIA, SOFEA, Service Oriented Front End Applications. So you have rich client side state, and then you have no server side state, of course, and then what little interaction there is between the client, be it Ajax or Flex or what have you, is done through RESTful HTTP, post and GET calls, because the browser can't do GET, can't do put and delete and so on, so it can only do post and GET. I think that's the trend right now. We have people building phone applications using, there's actually micro frameworks like Backbone.js, which provides the full-on, runtime, if you will, for you to build a structured application in one single page in JavaScript.
Well,
it's crazy.
Something I hear that keeps popping up, and one of the podcasts I listen to is the Java Posse, and they're mentioning stuff like HTML5, and I see it mentioned in emails and stuff through work. And it's like I feel like I'm not sure I know enough to appreciate what is HTML5 bringing, and how does that square with all this JavaScript and service-oriented stuff? Where does that fit into the scheme of things?
Lots of different parts of the puzzle. HTML5, of course, describes not one specification, but an umbrella, a set of commonly associated technologies and standards. One of them is web workers, this idea that you can have background threads on a web page, which is, of course, a natural fit for things like Comet. For sending server-side events down to the client, pushing that information. Another thing is it brings a much enhanced, drawing layer. Whether you're using Canvas, which is it's just that. It's a canvas that you can embed on the page that you can actually interrogate and work with just like you would the Java 2D, APIs. You can actually paint it, or using something like WebGL to get full-on hardware-accelerated 3D, and rendering. So from that perspective, there's nothing you can't draw in the browser these days, So now the question is, how does that translate into a beautiful, beautiful web application experience, And then HTML5 itself also has new form elements, so building form-heavy business data sort of centric applications should be easier because you should be able to specify, dates and emails and have validations on the client in the form control itself. But these pieces are not common yet,
Well, I remember this conversation like from 10 years ago when we were starting to build a particular application for a proposal, and one of the people said, it was Java, and they were said, so are we going to build applets or are we going to build servlets? Are we going to build applet? Are we going to draw, are we going to use JSPs to render everything? And, my other colleague said, those are totally different things. Essentially, he was saying, you don't know what you're talking about because there's some cases we're going to need servlets, but there may be other cases we need the applets. I don't know if this is the new So are we going to build HTML5, or are we going to use a particular JavaScript library, or, you know, are we having to pick and choose, or is this stuff really work together well, or is this still a wait and see?
There's no mutually exclusive choice to be made here. You can choose a JavaScript framework and use HTML5. Frameworks like jQuery, for example, are great for taking regular HTML4. You know, what I mean by HTML4 is more like HTML4.5. You know, the technologies that were, you know, contemporary last week, not today's HTML5 stuff, but last week's HTML4.9. You can take pages that are built across those browsers, you know, across that kind of technology brand, and update just parts of it to get this interactivity and the AJAX and the progressive enhancement. And then you can take those same skills and build full on, you know, here's my rich application on a page, and it's not, you know, it's not HTML sent down from the server to the client. It's full on interactive DOM manipulation happening in the client, you know. So I feel like the choice isn't between a JavaScript framework and HTML5. You can do both. You should be able to do, if you're willing to bet on HTML5 and limit your application to the people who are able to perceive and use HTML5 content, then you can do that, but you have the same tools. The difference, I think, is now people are starting to say, okay, well, I want to handle more of my business logic in the client. And once you start doing that, now you're saying, I want to handle less on the server implicitly, right? So that's where you start to need like an architectural framework like Backbone.js to actually handle the MVC pieces on the client side, you know? That's the only difference. But you'll still even use that with jQuery and things like that.
And only limited by whether or not you're using Internet Explorer, right?
but even there, I'm the first to... I'm the first to pick on Internet Explorer 5, you know, Internet Explorer if I can, but I gotta tell you, have you seen Internet Explorer 10?
I think it was a 10, or I was at my father-in-law's house. He needed something upgraded, and I forgot if he had IE 9 or 10, because he's got like the latest computer you can buy from Costco.
Sweet.
So I forgot, I didn't know what version that was, but go on.
Well, so 9 is it, you know. Let's be honest. When it came out, it wasn't that bad, but it's since been eclipsed pretty quickly by the latest and greatest in Firefox and Chrome. But Internet Explorer 10 is looking really, really solid. Actually, the people that are doing Sencha. Have you heard of Sencha? That's the what is that? The YUI.
Okay, I've heard of YUI. I'm not sure what that. I don't know much about that one. I'll tell you.
Did I get that right? It's a Sencha. Is a company that's taken. Is it YUI? I think it is. No, it's XJS, which is in turn. Sorry, I get them so conflated because the history is so long and storied. There was at some point something called YUI, which is of course still around. I think they're at version 3. YUI is the Yahoo User Interface framework, and it is basically a one stop shop. If you wanna build a YUI application, you get the YUI JavaScript code, and it basically launches its own little Linux kernel inside your browser. It's such a big,
wow,
convoluted ecosystem of scripts, you know. This is nice because it means you don't have to go anywhere else for anything else. You know, you have layout, you have special effects, AJAX, remoting, all that stuff, you know. And then XJS is, I think at one point that was originally the special effects module out of YUI, or I might be getting that wrong, but at some point they forked off, and then Sencha, a company that is building rich web app technologies on HTML5, they're the sort of shepherds of XJS, and they also have this thing called Sencha Touch, which brings, you know, rich interactivity and HTML5-based UI toolkits and technologies to mobile environments and tablets and so on.
Well, one of the things, you know, mobile's a big thing, even, you know, especially with the smartphone, you know, revolution that's happened in the past, what, 3 years or so.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff that has caught me by surprise is, like we use Zimbra for email, and I've been using it on my desktop and stuff. You know, most of the time I use on the iPhone, I use the Mail app, but there are issues with it or something, so I just pulled up the browser to navigate to our Zimbra website, and I didn't know that it had an iPhone mode for it.
Does it? Wow,
yeah,
that's
yeah, it
really
does.
Cool.
It looks really nice, and they've and the thing is, Yahoo's made updates and stuff because my wife surfs Yahoo, and I won't let her set up her account to download onto my iPhone because it's going to flood the system. But
naturally,
but they've updated their interface to look good on the iPhone. You know, to have, you know, they have little icons that look like the same icons if you're, you know, if you're writing a text message, the little square box with the pencil in it. Sure. They kind of have the same icon on Yahoo's mail page. So when you want to, you know, you tap it to compose a new message.
Oh yeah, well,
and this is stuff where this is stuff where you sniff. You know, you can sniff what the client is, and you send them the correct version of the interface through the thing. And this is intriguing material.
Oh yeah, and increasingly it's becoming less of a burden on the developer and more something the framework can do for you. There's no magic bullet, of course. There's no silver bullet, rather. There's no way to build a UI that looks good on all form factors. But it is becoming easier. You know, you don't have to build two apps now. You can build one and a half apps, you know.
I think it should be there's no virtual bullet, but...
There you go. No virtual bullet, except for VMware, of course, because we all love you.
Absolutely, and that's
yeah.
I was gonna say I just recently upgraded VMware Fusion to version 4 or whatever. So that's
how do you find it? I'm not on I'm not much of a Mac guy. How's it working for you?
So, well, I mean, on my Unix desktop or my Ubuntu Linux, I need to get the latest version of was it Workstation? Is that the
yeah?
Is that what you use?
Yeah.
But
well, how'd you like Fusion 4? Is it should I upgrade?
I don't know. I don't use it a lot. I'll tell you, I hit my testing limits on it when I was writing Spring Python 1.1. I started off and I was on a I was doing all that writing on the Windows platform.
Yeah,
that was the fun thing. I was writing during my lunch break, so I was working on my desktop computer in Windows, writing the material with the templates that the publisher gave me. But all the code I was writing was in Python. I didn't have this junk on Windows, so I had punched a hole in my firewall at home so I could use PuTTY to connect back to my home desktop to get to Ubuntu Linux. So I would capture screenshots of Ubuntu sessions, and so I was writing all the code on Linux. But then in the middle of that is when I joined VMware.
Right. So I actually had the same experience. I hadn't really used VMware up until I was writing the book, and I had the same setup as you, but in reverse. I was on Linux and I needed to open up Microsoft Word, you know.
So I talked to Pack Publishing and I was like, well, you know, what are you gonna do for me here? Are you gonna help me out? It's like because all their templates were in Windows, so I ended up using VMware Fusion to run Windows so I could write, and you know, while at the same time I had virtualized Ubuntu to in another virtual machine to keep doing the coding work, and that. Running two virtualized machines at the same time on my laptop, I think, was the ultimate limit. That, you know, the thing sometimes that Windows virtual thing would crunch slowly on me.
Yeah.
So I was glad to get that behind me. And for the second time when they wrote a book, I was like, I'm not talking to you unless you got an OpenOffice template.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So they said, oh, we've got that.
Oh yeah, don't leave. I think that's a big part of the story. I think a lot of people are moving to more open publishing systems. Anyway, I didn't mean to digress. I was just curious.
So,
back to the mobile thing. I don't know. About a year ago, if you'd asked me, I mean, look at all the new stuff that we've got right now. I mean, as you know, let's be honest. Windows Phone. I mean, are you likely? Have you seen anybody using a Windows Phone?
No. The only possibility was if I went when I was at the DevLink conference last year in Nashville, Tennessee. Which is a heavily .NET oriented conference, but I see people with Android phones are everywhere. That or an
sure.
iPhone, or
yeah.
or something that's not a smartphone.
Right. Do you see many J2ME applications?
I can't remember the last time I saw a J2ME app,
or even a phone that ran it. Right. I remember I had my old IBM. I had the old Trio. Trio 600, whatever it was, and then that didn't have J2ME support on it, so I had to get the Did you know that IBM actually makes a J2ME? What is it? Runtime. They're actually in the business of licensing that.
Is that a J2ME version of JRocket?
No, this is IBM, not BEA. This is a... Go on.
I thought IBM made JRocket. Did I lose track? Or something?
That's Jikes, I think. JRocket was Oracle's or BEA's.
Oh, okay.
Right, and but it wasn't either way. It was their own little J2ME license, and that they made it available to other mobile handset makers. You know, and so they could license it. Well, the Trio 600 didn't have J2ME pre-installed. You know, the new versions did, but you had to get the licensed version. So, you know, this is what I considered consumer friendly back in 2005, whatever it was. You know, I went to IBM, got their J2ME runtime, installed it on the phone, on my Trio, and then that's how I ran my basic Gmail app and all that stuff. But now, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. I mean, if you consider, you wouldn't even dream of asking somebody to do that on their phone today. You know, there's just no need. They have much more powerful, much more sophisticated
Well, if memory serves, isn't J2ME the means through which they could claim that Java was on a billion devices out there? It was because so many phones had J2ME support on them.
Yeah, and
there's nothing that leaps out at you of like, wow, I love that J2ME app, you know?
No, well, that's the thing. I mean, I actually did quite a bit of J2ME work. At one point, and this should have been a sign, I should have known, at one point they had built a framework called Antenna, which was an ANT-based preprocessor for your Java code. Yeah, you heard me right. I'll say it again. It was an ANT-based preprocessor for your Java code. And that was the... Because there's no reflection. There's no runtime reflection in J2ME. Right? So you don't have the ability to do basic dynamicism, the kind of dynamicism you associate with Java today. You didn't have any of that in J2ME. It really wasn't pure. Yeah, in fact, you could use it and not have floating point. You know, it was a very different language. It was a very different beast. So if you wanted to have dynamic views that cross-compiled and worked on different devices, you needed a preprocessor. And that was Antenna, you know? Such a weird approach.
Well, I did see a demo. It was several years ago. We had business relations with Sun Microsystems, so they came and gave lunch presentations all the time. And one thing is they came and had a neat presentation where they had a ring on. One of their people was wearing a ring, and which embedded in the ring was a smart chip. And they had this little reader they could plug into a computer, so they could take the ring off, stick it into this little reader that would access the chip.
Wow.
And the thing would pop up, and essentially what they were pointing out is it had J2ME on it, and they'd built some kind of tic-tac-toe application.
Wow. So that's kind of cool, though.
They had the computer playing itself tic-tac-toe games over and over, running on the ring. So you're looking at that, and you're like, ooh, that was really cool. It was a neat lunchtime presentation, and then the presentation was over, and you went back to your job, and you forgot
about it. Yeah, like, what am I going to do with that, you know?
Yeah, and it was...
Thanks.
And I remember when we got, you know, because I built a software system that supported a 24/7 operations center, they issued us all cell phones so that the ops center could call us at 3 a.m. when the system crashed. And, you know, these phones...
Broke the job, huh?
You know, these phones had J2ME on it, and we were looking at each other like, hey, we could build some useful apps for that. And I went and downloaded the SDK for J2ME, and after trying to haggle with it for an hour, I just threw it in the trash and said,
"Yeah, that's pretty. I should have done that. You're much smarter than I am, there, Greg." Wish I'd known.
One of our people figured out was they figured out the mechanics of text messaging, which is all text messaging is a phone number at telcoprovider.com, and so they built a database and a little tiny Java app that would just simply connect to a mail server, and it's like that was the most useful app of all time that we had, which was, you know. System broke, pop up an app and automatically figure out who's relevant and send them a text message.
Right, exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know, like some of the simplest apps that, you know, facilitate business is that kind of stuff.
Yep, and actually that's a convention. There's not all SMS carriers support that, but the alternative is to do something like SMPP, which is a SMS gateway. And that, you actually have to go to somebody and pay them scads of money to be able to send messages through their gateway. So I think, yeah, I think like that application you just talked about, I think a lot of the internet was built on convenient hacks like that, you know?
Well, that, you know, when every time I think about that kind of thing, it reminds me of the quote, I forgot who said, you know, all applications will eventually send email or be replaced by one that does. I think, I'm trying to remember if that was Eric Raymond that said that.
Oh, I love Eric. What's he, I hope, that's another one. That's another guy. I hope he's in good health. Gracious. I don't think I could stand to lose him.
So, you know, that's...
been a bad week.
Yeah, we can't have three. I think that's only Hollywood stars, though, that come in threes.
Seriously, right? Do you remember 2005 and 6 or whatever? I mean, Katharine Hepburn and Ray Charles and... yeah, just like, everybody just seemed to die in the last decade. All these people from...
Who's going to be left when we're old people? I don't know. Is it...
Jay-Z or something? God.
I don't know. There's some comedy movie where it has this woman on there that she's you know, I forgot who it was. It was Jane Fonda, and she's kind of older, and she's interviewing some young new hotshot, and this girl on her show is like, you know, I love classic movies like Free Willy.
Oh my god!
And she's freaking out on the set, and I was just I just laughed at that like crazy, like, oh my gosh, that's what you and I are gonna be someday. Oh no!
this is Jane Fonda. Does she even know? Oh, that's so sad. Yeah. Well, that's I feel like that way about these old applications we're talking about. So let's talk about something new. No more of this J2ME stuff. I'm sorry I brought it up.
Hey, no, yeah. I may have skirted around JavaScript, and I'm kind of paying the price for that by catching up with it, and I find it's exciting stuff for me, but something else I skirted around, too, at the same time was J2EE, and I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know, I found out about Spring back in 2006 when somebody mentioned it, and I went and read the Spring Developer's Guide, and my eyeballs were, you know, wide open, like, oh, wow, this is awesome stuff. I just ate up that book overnight.
Yeah.
So I don't miss J2EE, and actually the stuff that the code that I was writing, this Forte 4GL, this stuff was really wicked at being able to build, you know, what they would call a service object. You could say is kind of equivalent to an EJB, but you didn't have to write like deployment descriptors. You basically picked a class, you set a particular attribute on it, saying this is a deployable object, and it, you know, it then gets a name, and you deploy it through their tools, which are really awesome. And then you can make remote calls on it from your GUI with little effort, and it handles all the dispatching, you know, seamlessly for you. And you can sit there and say, well, actually, I need two copies of that running so that there's a backup in case one goes down, and it handles all that for you. So, you know, when you come into building these intense client-side JavaScript apps, you know, that's where I'm having to catch up and learn the semantics of AJAX, because that's your RPC stuff is the AJAX, and now you have this REST, and now even AJAX is not as much as, would it be AJAJ, where it's not, people are now using more JSON than XML to interact.
Actually, that's a great point. So you bring up a great point, which is there's still very much a desire for people to build. People want to build applications, and they want to have the dispatch be smooth and seamless like it used to be. And a lot of these specialized environments are you know, they're like I said, they're eschewing JavaScript altogether, forsaking it for the web assembler that they think it is, and going to things like GWT. And one of the perks, I'm not saying I would choose JWT in my next project, but one of the perks of JWT and or Flex is a you get transparent remoting, you know? It just works. So you have this Java object on the server, and you just make sure it gets started up in the right servlet environment, and then you have a JavaScript client on the client, but you don't know that it's, you know, you don't have to deal with any of that, the nuances, you know? It just feels like you're talking to another object, basically. It feels like that when you write the code. And it's very, very transparent, you know? I can see the appeal in that. But I think the remoting stuff now is getting to the point where it's so simple, you know, people are biting, they're biting their lips and they're going for it. It's not that bad. REST is quite nice for these kinds of scenarios, you know?
Now, is it Spring 3 or is it Spring 2.5 where they heavily added the RESTful support to the to Spring MVC, where it basically made every all the Spring MVC endpoints into where they provided RESTful services. Can you remember that?
Yeah, so 2.5, it was possible, but really what you're talking about, where it had full-blown support for REST is 3.0. And, you know, that support, it's very natural. If you're already using Spring MVC and you want to start rendering objects, you know, RESTful payloads as JSON or XML, it just becomes another type of view, basically. It just plugs in naturally. So I quite like that support. And once you've gotten past that little hurdle of, okay, well, I've got a RESTful app, let's connect to it. I mean, it's very, very easy, you know, and the JavaScript frameworks are up to the task, you know. I think that's why a lot of people are building apps on iOS and on Android, and, you know, they're using things like PhoneGap, you know, or Titanium to build portable applications that can talk to these back-end services.
Well, that was
the SDKs common.
Well, I think, like, it was back in, was it 2009 or something? I remember my in-laws asked me, they said, what do you want for Christmas? And I was scratching my head, and I thought about a handful of books that I wanted to get. One is I wanted to get caught up on this JavaScript stuff. So I looked up the, I think it was the O'Reilly JavaScript reference book or something.
Yeah.
And this other one called Professional Ajax. I put it on the list, and they went and bought them all for me. So I was like, okay. So, you know, I was reading about, you know, how to, you know, I was like, I've read about Ajax on the blogs, and that's kind of a high level intro. So I was like, let me get my hands into it. And, you know, that the JavaScript book, I found it really fascinating, where, you know, behind all the DOM and the Ajax and stuff like that, there's really kind of a neat language underneath it.
Oh yeah.
That language of JavaScript. I was like, that's a really, you know, fascinating language to it. But then I was even more scooped up when I started studying Dojo and seeing how they've got the libraries to do the Ajax requests for you.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess the other toolkits and stuff that are comparable functionality, they do it too, because everyone needs to do Ajax, so everyone's like, let's help you do it.
Right.
And it's impressive there that you can then, like you said, go throw together your Spring app and have it serve up the RESTful endpoint, so you can, you know, glue the stuff together.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Dude, I really like Dojo. I mean, it's one of those things where I'm not sure people would choose it today, but when it first came out, 2006 or whatever, 2005, you know, there was not a lot like it. I mean, YUI, the aforementioned YUI, that's another one where it's a full, you know, everything but the kitchen sink kind of JavaScript framework, you know, and it's really robust and it takes care of your layout, your components, and your remoting and all that stuff. It's hard to believe that this is all built on the back of something that was considered, you know, good for animating GIFs and buttons and stuff just 10 years ago. You mentioned learning JavaScript. I learned JavaScript, and, you know, old school JavaScript hackers among your audience will recognize this. The TAU, T-H-A-U, WebMonkey tutorial back in the late 90s. By a guy named Tao. Do you remember webmonkey.com?
No, that was not ringing a bell.
Oh, it was I'm almost embarrassed to admit it. It was a Wired magazine web development port.
Huh.
Right? So they took their inertia around WebMonkey and, around Wired magazine and Hotbot and all these other things. This is when Wired magazine was cool, if there was time. Right? Yeah, it was. And they took that inertia and they built this web development community in the late 90s called WebMonkey. And it was really, really, you know, it was kind of interesting. I mean, back in the 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of kind of interesting content there. But in particular, the one that really got hot was Tao's JavaScript tutorial. And I remember, do you remember No Starch Press?
No.
That was a publisher, and they actually published the Tao. They got the same guy, I think his name was Michael Tao, T-H-A-U. They got the same guy to write a JavaScript book.
Don't tell me it was called the Tao of Tao.
Oh, that would have been good. No, I forget what it was, but it was just such a quirky... I mean, have you read the Learn Yourself a Haskell for Greater Good or something like that?
No way! I think I've heard of that one. I think I put that one on my list of books to read, because I was wanting to. With studying Scala, a lot of people make reference to Haskell, so I was like, you know, I'll probably have to read a little bit of Haskell too.
Right. Well, that one's actually a big free tutorial. It's a book. Yeah, you can buy it, but there's also a free
it's
version.
Like an, yeah, electronic. It's like a PDF or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's it's a good introduction, but it's also very quirky, and it's written by a guy who's got a sense of humor. and the Tao one had that same effect 10 years ago. You know, it was a it's a great way to learn the language. But the point is, when you follow this tutorial, I mean, the thing that they talked about, the thing they dwelled on was, you know, here's how you make an image animate. Here's how you do a mouse over, and here's how you do basic validation in a form, and you know, this was the JavaScript and the internet of Netscape 3 and Internet Explorer 3. You know, so that's where I started. Now you show me the frameworks we have today, and I'm just blown away. I can't believe we're talking about the same language. You know, just amazing. Aren't you the one who was telling me about that? Somebody had built a JavaScript Linux kernel.
Yeah, somebody. I saw that Twittered, and it was a. You went and visited this, and you saw a shell pop up in your browser, and it took you a few seconds to realize that's a Linux shell that you can go type into, and it's running in your browser. It's not. You're not looking at an animated picture.
Wow!
And it's. You know, and I was like, "What the heck is this?" Well, it can only be JavaScript, right? What else? It's not. This isn't an applet or. It's like, wow, I was like, okay, who had that much time to go write that?
Well, I'm impressed that they could, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. Absolutely incredible. That's a lot of that stuff I think is due. You mentioned HTML5, actually. A lot of that is, you know, we have this support for rich types in the JavaScript language now, these typed arrays and things like that, you know? So I imagine, I mean, actually, the WebGL stuff, same thing, they have. You know, when you're doing floating point graphics and 3D rendering, all that stuff, you need the ability to do typed floating point values and vertices and so on. So the JavaScript language is kind of upgraded to support in a few cases where typing is really, really, really important. And so it's a very different language. I don't know. I mean, the fact that they can get a Linux kernel, you know, running, it's just amazing. They actually had... Do you remember they had... I remember seeing it at Google I/O a few years ago. The GWT team had taken, and I'm trying to remember what it was, they had taken Java code, and that Java code was in turn talking to C code, and that C code plus the Java code combined was a, it was just pure Java. It was a Quake implementation, right? So they had taken Quake, and they had run the game, and you could actually run, it was a first person, you know, it's a shooter, right? It's a game. You're walking around in the game. You're doing all this stuff. And they had now ported this Java code onto GWT, which in turn cross-compiled it into JavaScript. So they had Quake running in the browser using HTML5 audio and HTML5 graphics. You know, and it was amazing. They're actually getting something like 30 frames a second or whatever. I mean, it was really, really impressive. Just amazing.
Now you talk about cross compiling to JavaScript. That brings up a fun subject. This new thing that came out from Google, the Dart language.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna just say right now I haven't had a chance to really play with it, so I don't really know. I looked at it; it looks kind of like a C language. You know, it looks. I don't know. I kind of like it, but.
I haven't had a chance to look at it either. One thing I've looked at is somebody went and compiled a Hello World Dart program and had it transpiled to JavaScript. So they're kind of showing off that this thing has like 16,000 lines of code in it, but then I once wrote a Hello World program in Ada, and that comes to 1 megabyte. So you know it that's the whole, you know, I guess effective runtime that they have in the Dart language with it.
Oh wow!
So I think that's what a lot of the structure that's in there. So you know, if you dig around, you go find actual the state, you know, that Hello World statement that's in there. But you know, if you go write 100 line JavaScript or Dart program, whatever, it's going to be 16,000 and 100 lines, you know.
Right, yeah. Well, we're building on the shoulders of giants, right? Standing on the shoulders of giants, I guess. I guess you're going to... It's going to be... So are you saying that Dart's runtime is the new Visual Basic, you know,
VB.dll? I don't know. That could have a very editorial statement if I said that.
No, I'm not saying... do you remember people have to... We used to have to lug around that DLL everywhere? For all these different applications. Maybe that's what we're looking at now, is bringing our runtime with us for our use cases. Yeah, interesting. I don't know, the Dart... I agree that we need a I mean, a lot of people, you know, I don't think anybody would disagree that a structured language for web applications couldn't hurt, you know. But what's more interesting to me is the other implications of Dart. I think Google intends for that to become a general purpose applications language like Java, not just in the browser. The primary compiler, in fact, doesn't emit JavaScript. It emits regular code that you can run standalone, if I understand correctly, if I read correctly. So, you know, that could be very powerful, right? Because the big platform that helped catapult Java into the eyes of everybody was applets, right? It was in the browser, but it was a full language. And it was,
right. You know, and if it's Google, what is Google developing? Was it JavaScript, Python? Was it
Java?
And was it
C++?
C++. I didn't know if it was HTML that they counted as their fourth language or something like that, but. I mean, I could see them being the ones to say, we're now going to have Dart transpile into Python or, you know, their other platforms, and can they use it as a leveraging tool? So I guess we're all waiting to see what Google does next with it.
Yeah, I it's a little...
It's going to be in beta. It'll be in beta for the next 3 years, probably.
just like their email. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty excited. It's a new language. That's always good. More variety. Get people more interested in building modern day applications. They've got to match up with good tooling, though. Good environment. You know, a good ecosystem for the developers. JavaScript has the virtue and the problem of being very easy to plunk down on a page in a regular text editor and just see it run. You know, so you don't really need, you know, the Eclipse and the IntelliJ's of the world for JavaScript. I don't feel like a lot of people start in a full-blown IDE for JavaScript.
Well, you say bits of JavaScript. Have you ever tinkered with the Lyft framework?
Yeah.
Written in Scala?
Oh,
and,
sure.
And how they have their support for things like Ajax and stuff, where they, you know, essentially they have a statically typed JavaScript library. Its job is it emits bits of JavaScript, so... You know, if you're only needing little bits and pieces here to make Ajax work and stuff like that, you don't have to go write JavaScript. You use their statically type-safe code, you know, until you actually get, unless you're going to write some real, you know, really rich thing, then they're like, you know, sidestep that and just go write real JavaScript. You know, I found that really fascinating approach, and somebody who tweeted and says, you know, I built this JavaScript library, now I'm going to go port it to Lyft. I thought that was an interesting take on that. Like, let's take this library and put it in the hands of the Lyft community so they can use it in their apps.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you're going to have that. I mean, that's actually a lot of people, and I can see the point. I can see the point of, you know, I want an adult language to deal with. I don't want to work with JavaScript. So you have ActionScript for Flex. You have, like we said, CoffeeScript or whatever for JavaScript, and now Lyft. And GWT and Dart. Wow, seems to be kind of a trend, actually. I wonder if that's the new thing. Do you remember how everybody used to build web MVC frameworks, and then after that it was JavaScript frameworks seemed to be de rigueur for the last couple of years, and now maybe everybody's got to build their own cross-compiling JavaScript language thing.
I don't know. It's some interesting stuff. I'm going to keep my thumb on the pulse of it, but... we may have to draw things to a close here. I think I hear one of my kiddos making a peep there. I may have to go check on him. So.
Uh oh.
The Pond Jumpers would like to thank the Skype call recorder team, who's made it easy to record Skype phone calls. Please send us any feedback or contact us about any potential interviews. We love talking about anything open source. Visit our webpage at pondjumpers.com or send us a message through our contact form or simply email us at contact@pondjumpers.com. All writings and recordings produced by Pond Jumpers are published through a Creative Commons license and copyrighted by Greg Turquist and Russ Miles. The content of this podcast and website does not represent any of the companies mentioned nor their opinions. The intro and exit music is the upbeat Roxanne, Sweet Romana, and purchased from opuz.com, the site for royalty-free production music.
Working from both sides of the pond, the Pond Jumpers are Greg Turnquist and Russ Miles.